All right, let's move on to structured data and then come back to the half object next week. I think we'll have time. Yeah. Okay. So a little bit more on sending the data around the place. What we've done so far is we sent a couple of strings, so we haven't sent anything complicated yet. But we could be sending more complicated things. So you might be sending some integers, you might be sending some single characters, some bytes, you might be sending an ordinary string, all sorts of different things. Whatever format you send, the client's got to be able to read that format, and so you've got this mutual agreement problem. They have to agree upon what the format's going to be before messages can be read. Usually, you don't exchange information about the format. So there's an agreement beforehand. Both client and server know the format, so you don't have to negotiate it. Okay. Or that's in the mutual agreement mechanism, at any rate. So the mutual agreement, everyone knows, and you don't do any negotiation. This is used by a lot of the protocols, for example, for remote procedure calls. So Java's RMI, Sun's RPC, a lot of these mechanisms use that. Okay, so, and the advantage of that, there's no overheads, because if you're not sending any superfluous information that the other side already knows. Okay. The problem with that mechanism is if one of them gets it a little bit wrong, then it just stuffs up the whole conversation between them. So if, for example, the client is expecting to receive a byte and is instead sent 4 bytes as an int, well, it will only read, if it's only expecting 1 byte, it'll only read 1, which means there are still 3 sort of sitting in that network queue waiting to be read the next time round, and the client won't know what to do with 3 bytes which aren't in the right format. So if anything goes wrong, it's a sort of fragile mechanism that because everything must be perfectly right in order for it to succeed. So safer messages would include some sort of maybe redundant information, but some sort of type information as to what is in that message. One of the simplest is the internet mail format. And it's a character-based mechanism. It was originally just for sending a single message from one person to another. Since then, it's been extended in lots of ways. So you get mail with attachments. You're familiar with that. Mail with attachments had to extend the original mail format so that it would know what an attachment was. So what was in the original format was just a bit of header information and the data body. And the original design, they left it fairly open as to what you could put in that header. So originally it was just sort of from and to, but then people started adding in carbon copies, date sent, all sorts of extra header information. And what the mail format consists of is these sort of keywords followed by data, one per line usually, and then a blank line. And that blank line signals that it's the end of the header, it's the beginning of the body. So your actual text starts after that. Okay. And this is where it started. Each line ends in carriage returned line feed. Okay. When they wanted to add in things like attachments, they then started making it a bit more complicated, and especially when you're sending things like binary data through mail, then they had to start labeling what types of information were coming in the message. So the first part that was added was to say that you've got a content type. So previously, it always used to be just ASCII text. Now if you're sending a Word document or an image or something as an attachment, the content type describes what is the type of data that's coming through. And this MIME type, so-called MIME type, consists of a top-level classification, and that says text, image, video, and so on. And the specific type gives you more information about it. So as for text, it could be plain text, HTML text, Word document text, all different types. Content length is fairly simple because that just says how big the data is going to be, 10 bytes, 20 bytes, whatever. That was added by HTTP, was not originally in the mail format, came across later. Content transfer encoding, talk a bit about later, but main things, content type, content length. So there's a standard classification for those, application for the top level type, application, audio, image, multi-part, so you can send multiple attachments, text and video. You have the option of creating new types if you want, and they're X-something. So sometimes you'll see a MIME type X-something or another. It's a non-standard one. So within the minor types, things like an image, you can say it's a JPEG image, an image, you can say it's a GIF image, etc. What that encoding is for is to say a little bit about the data format that you're sending it in. Supposing you want to send an image file that's got lots of binary data in it. One of the problems with internet systems a long time ago was if you tried to send 8-bit binary data around the network, then lots of the stages along there would strip off the top bit. The original ASCII format was 7-bit, so a lot of gateways and routers were assuming that 7-bit data was going to come around the place. And it would use the 8th bit as a parity checker, because there were lots of sort of errors in the early days. So at one stage, the only data that was being sent was 7-bit data with the 8th bit used for a parity checker. So if you wanted to send binary data around, stuff that was originally 8-bit, you'd have to spread it out a little bit into a 7-bit format and then send that 7-bit format around. And there are things like, I can't remember the encodings now. 64, K64. There's a number of different encodings for how to spread 8-bit data into 7-bit. And what this transfer encoding tells you is what actual format the data is appearing in. Might be compressed, it might be 7-bit, so that when it gets to the other end, you can decode it from that transport mechanism into what it should be. Base64 was the encoding, yeah. So for example, if you wanted to send a zip file, then one way of sending it would be to say the content type is a zip application. The 8-bit data has been spread into a 7-bit format using the base64 encoding, and then all the data follows, and it looks quite... it's just a bunch of ASCII text. When it gets to the other side, then there's a base64 decoder, which will take all of that textual stuff, turn it back into the 8-bit binary format, which should be a zip file. Okay, so that's one way in which you can give some sort of information about the data that's going to follow by saying what the data is a zip file, and it's encoded in a particular way. Here's the data, so you don't need to always be sending zip files. You can figure it out on the fly. There's a notation called ASN.1, which took this to quite an extreme sort of level, basically. What ASN.1 was trying to do was to say, just to make it perfectly safe, every bit of data will carry along with it a description of what that data is. So it had a number of basic types. So say you can send integers, we can send ASCII, you can send octets, 8 bits binary data, and you can also send sequences like arrays or sets of things. And in order to make sure that it would get across the right way, that you would send both the data and the description of the data. So that if you wanted to send two things, an integer 10 and a string, you'd say, we're going to send you a sequence. And the sequence consists of an integer, and here's its value. And the next thing in the sequence is an ASCII string, and here's its value. So everything was self-describing in that way. The data type, and then followed by the data. That was okay, but then they looked at that and said, well, there's a lot of wasted stuff in here. That why are we sending these eight characters here? Why are we sending those characters here? Can we can sort of compact it down a little bit? And the problem was they did. And they compacted it down to the extent that nobody can read it, nobody can write programs for it, and hardly anybody ever uses it anymore. The basic idea was fine. It's just that the encoding was so complicated that nobody can figure out what's going on. Even the tutorials are horrible to read. The only place this ever gets used nowadays, as far as I can see, you've heard of PKI, public key encryption, certificate authorities like VeriSign, X509 certificates. So if you want to verify who you are, you can buy what's called a digital certificate from a PKI authority. And the digital certificate will contain information about who you are, who you work for, and so on. And it's been signed by an authority like VeriSign. The actual format of those digital certificates is in ASN.1. And that's about the only use that I've ever seen of that format. So the idea is simple, but they just made it too complicated to use. Okay. XML is also an expression of that kind of mechanism, but that's much easier to use. So it's the current flavor for representation of data of various forms. It's character-based, so it means it's easier to read. And you can at least read through an XML document, even if you can't figure out all the details of it. How it was sold in the first place was as a means of extending HTML by being able to define your own tags. So you're not restricted to body, head, paragraph, and so on. Define your own tags and define your own attributes. So if you wanted to use an XML type format to send messages from a client to a server, say a login message, you could send as this string saying we've got a request. It's a request for that name, and we're sending that password as well, along as well. And the difference between that and just login, name, password is that if you send login, name, password, both sides have to have knowledge beforehand of the format. Whereas with this, with XML, the receiving side can look at the message and analyze the message to figure out what's in it. So, for example, you might be able to swap the order of name and password. And that won't make any difference to what's receiving it, because the receiver will be able to say, here's the name, here's the password. But if you're sending login, name, password, and you swap those two, then the other side will get confused. So this is more robust as a means of sending data around. And replies could be something like login reply status as an attribute within it. Status succeeded, login reply status failed. Lots of different ways of writing these things. Okay, if you want to send a directory listing back, for example, you could say directory listing reply, how many files are you sending? And follow that with a bunch of file names, for example. So self-describing data in that format. Okay. There's lots of tutorials. If you haven't come across XML before, I think most of you probably will have, there's tutorials around the place, such as at that place. And there's books, 500-page books and so on. Okay. Okay. If you want to get a bit more formal than just making up tags, there are two ways of describing how you can bring some formality and say, what's the structure, for example, of a DIR reply? From this, we can see that it's got that sort of the tag dir reply, nested tags, file count, and a bunch of file names. But you can give a formal description of saying a dir reply must have a format fitting this pattern. And there are two ways of doing it. One's through document type definitions, and one is through schema. Okay. DTD method was the first one they came up with, and that was really good for structure, but not much good for data types. And so they invented XML schema, which is good for data types, but no good at structure. So DTDs were around for quite some time, and then people said, there's a problem with DTDs, let's go and find a solution. And they made the solution worse than the original problem, is what some people think. But anyway, so you've got two different ways of describing the same type of situation. How you describe the login request is to say, firstly, what are the tags that are going to be used within a login request? And these are all described by this this element here. So within an element, it says one of the tags is going to be a login request. Another tag is going to be a name, and a third tag is going to be a password. And how they're related is that we're going to have nested tags. So if we go back up and look at the structure there, with a login request, there was an outer tag, and name was nested inside it, password was nested inside it. So you describe that by, within the login request element, you give a list of the tags that will appear within that. And it's just a brackets and comma separated list. What was inside the name tag? I'll go back up again. What was inside the name tag was just a piece of text. What was inside the password tag was just a piece of text. So you describe that by saying, what's inside the name tag is this hash PC data, which just says it's a string. Okay. So the structure is given, login request has nested tags, name and password, name contains a string, password contains a string. Okay. The directory replies one, the three tags are dir reply, file count, file name, and the structure is that there is a file count followed by any number. Plus stands for zero or more file names. And what's the file count? Well, it's a string. What's a number? But it's a string. And what's the file name? It's a string. So that tells you what the structure is, and a very tiny amount of information about what the data types are. Basically, they're all strings. So XML schema was to try and get around the fact that you can't say much more than strings. You can't say integers. Everything's just PC data. And you couldn't talk properly about dates and arrays and things. So XML schema were to try and fix that up. And this now gets pretty complicated. So if you wanted to do the schema for login requests, firstly, you have this big horrible chunk which says that you're using XML schema, you're using the standard stuff from the W3 consortium, and it defines things like namespaces, which you don't have to worry about. Okay. Except what it says here is things like this. So the first line is saying that XSD is stands for X schema definition, and everyone's supposed to know what an X schema definition is. So within the X schema definition, we're defining an element. So this is the same kind of thing as what the bracket hash was doing earlier. So we're defining a tag by saying it's an element, which has got a particular name, and we've got some other tags of, here's another element down here, which has got the name, and another element which has got the password. So the three tags are password, name, and login request. Okay. For the type login request, it's those tags with something nested inside it. So you then say there's a data type that's going to correspond to that. And that data type is going to appear a bit further down. So the type is a login request. That type, because it's the nested, had those nested things in it, is not just a simple thing, it's a complex one. So the login request is a complex type, and it consists of a sequence of things, one after another. So there's a sequence, finish the sequence, and within that sequence is the name tag and the password tag. And now finally you get to the sort of value of it, of saying, well, what types of things can we put in a name? We can put a string. What types of things can we put in a password? We can put a string. And what XML schema then does is lists all of the possible data values that you can have in places like here. So the structure has got much more complicated, but down in here, you've got the ability to put types. Okay. What are those types? There's a standard list. You can see it later. It includes things like integers, shorts, longs, unsigned, signed, strings of various kinds, dates of various types, and so on. So there's a whole bunch of fairly standard types that you can put in there. And we better stop at that point. Okay. So we'll do how the Java handling for that next week.